we started with RAB equals zero, and we have yet made absolutely no contact with a 3 plus 1 decomposition. We haven't said how we're going to define a moment of time at which we're going to define data and evolve forward in time. We have yet to say anything related to the concepts that we introduced when we discussed the ADM. So in the end, in the ADM formulation of Einstein's equations, what we're evolving is the time derivative, so two equations for the intrinsic metric to a given hypersurface, the extrinsic curvature to a given hypersurface that tells us how to proceed in time. These functions, which in total we have 12, are not completely free to be given. We have these constraints that we had to satisfy, and which restrict particular combinations of these variables coming to satisfy some particular conditions, which we know what those are when we write the constraints. And we had to give these four free pieces of information, the lapse and shift, to obtain at least a well-defined system where it's, well, posed is a different thing, but at least a priori is something that is complete. We discussed briefly yesterday, we didn't get into much of the details, but we kind of motivated what are some of the problems when one finds when one prescribes this lapse and shift in a perhaps simplistic manner. We chose, for instance, the lapse, the shift to zero, and we saw that if we took the lapse to be one, we were in trouble. We ended up with a weakly hyperbolic system. When we tied it to, say, the behavior of the dynamics of the system, then we got a much better formulation. So those issues will come back in a different form here, simply because on this side of things, the ones we're discussing now, what we're evolving is all variables. We're evolving all components of the metric. So rather than a subset here given by 12, we have this many. Of course, if I can always introduce a variable, formally, let me just use a different name, QAB to be given by, say, GAB time derivative, or related to the time derivative of GAB, we could have also some space derivatives. That's fine. So we could rewrite the system now as GAB dot equals something, QAB dot equal, well, the right-hand side of this equation. But where are the constraints? We don't see the constraints here. Where do they go? Well, the constraints go in this formulation in order to have a well-defined system in the coordinate conditions that we introduce, say, equal to something. So here is the constraints of our system. Before, we had these constraints. Now, these constraints have turned into this. I still have to make a connection of how we're going to define some initial data, how we're going to even make sense of a given hypersurface and evolving to the future. But this is kind of the two ways of interpreting things that we have. So let's stay here for a while, and then we're going to come back here. So at the end of, towards the end of yesterday's class, we wrote, or we indicated that the Ricci tensor in the Didonder form can be written in this way, where the only thing we've done is just to group some terms in a particular convenient form. So we put everything that only contained one derivative of the metric together, and we could lump this in this terms over there. We kept together the piece of the metric that came with just a derivative that looked very much like the wave equation. You just have operating as if it operates in a with respect to some arbitrary fields, which are the GABs. So here we see this part of the equations that is the D'Alembertian in on the curved side, where the weights are given by this G alpha beta. And then that contains second derivative symmetric. The other piece, everything else, one can see that can be combined in this way, which is the covariant derivative of this Christoffel symbols. We notice that if we just happen to define this in a sufficiently convenient way, we can end up with a system that should have these nice properties of symmetric hyperbolicity, simply because this term is symmetric hyperbolic. This is the one that spoils it. So we have several options at our disposal. One is to say, well, let me choose that to be zero, because this implies that we're choosing coordinates in such a way. So that's something that certainly we could do. But we may worry a little bit a priori when we have to see what happens in practice, that this might be too restrictive, that we're choosing the Christoffels or the coordinates to obey a very restrictive condition. We have zero. Again, if we write Schwarzschild, for instance, in Cartesian coordinates, and you evaluate where it is satisfied, you find out that indeed they are satisfied better and better as you go further away from the centered object. But if you write, again, Schwarzschild in spherical coordinates, and you try to evaluate this, you see that that's non-zero. So if you choose to impose these coordinates and want to use spherical coordinates, there is an incompatibility because this is not going to be satisfied as you go further from the source. So you say, well, that's not too difficult. I can say this is equal to some function. So again, this is now telling us that this is what we're choosing. And because now when I make this replacement in here, this is what I want. Either I choose gamma b equal to 0 or gamma b equal hb. When I put it in here, then in this case, this term will either be 0. In this case, this term would be given by that. That's what I meant to write. Of course, now we have changed the nature of the problem. We went from, okay, worrying that 0 might be too restrictive to worrying how in the world we're going to choose these HBs in a convenient fashion. So again, if we think again of the Schwarzschild example in spherical coordinates, we can grab Schwarzschild. We can evaluate what this would be. We're going to obtain a source. Let's define the source to be HAB, and that's what we're putting here. And because what we're putting here is a term that is completely analytic, it's closed form, there is no second derivative of the metric that comes in, and we still have our principal part of the problem, I mean, the problem throwing away all the lower order terms defined just by this part, and therefore everything is just nice. But we might not be as lucky as to be able to guess a priori what these functions could be. We might want to tie these functions somehow to the dynamics of the system, but we want to do it in such a way that we still don't spoil this behavior. So another option is to define some dynamical HBs somehow, and you're free to do anything you want as long as you do it without spoiling what you work hard to get in the first place. So what I mean by this is, suppose, let me just give you a simple example. Let me define. There's something that you pick for whatever reason. Let me just do this. This is not a good option, but let me just say, well, I'm saying, okay, the H's will change with time, and I should have some vector here. The H's will change with time. We'll obey that equation. But, so H's varies dynamically or in time, but it's not coupled with the G. So regardless of what's going on with the perturbations that may propagate on the sector governed by the fields that determine the metric, H is completely impervious to that, right? So that's one option. Another option I could say is, well, let me just try to make something more complicated. I'll do something like this. I don't know. Again, so I'm just picking this out of a hat to illustrate the point. Now, I am coupling the variation of H, the rate of change of H, to the metric G. So I could worry that now I'm spawning everything that I work to get. But we're not doing that because this is a second order equation. Here I only see a first derivative. And everything, remember, that is lower order, we're dropping. But that would mean every time we see an equation, we only keep the highest derivatives, and any derivative is lower than that, either in this case first order or second order, is assumed to not play any role. So when I see this equation, this is something that I will drop. I won't worry about it. Analogously, I could have a term that goes like, I don't know, again, I'm just pulling this out of a hat. Now I have a derivative of g, but it's a first order derivative. It's not a second order derivative. Therefore, even though they are coupled through lower order terms, and we can ignore that. And so something that has been very successful is to say, well, I have a wave equation for g. Let's try to get the coordinates to react as fast, quote unquote, as g is varying. So if I have a wave equation for g, the one possible option is to decide that, define that h will also evade a wave equation, but I'm going to couple h through the metric. So it's coupled already here because g appears in here, right? So this would be g alpha beta d alpha d beta of hab. And I can put a zero, or I can even do some more things. And something that Franz Pretorius used when he solved the problem, this binary problem, for the first time, he wanted these h's, and then we'll see in a second why this is useful, but he wanted these h's to react to two very possibly very nasty situations. One is, so again, we're evolving GAB, that's our metric, but we can always re-express this GAB, we know, in terms of the lapse, the shift, and gij. There's nothing that prevents us from doing that. And we know whenever this lapse goes to zero or negative, this shouldn't make any sense because the lapse is something that measures the proper time between one slice and the next one. If the lapse goes to zero, we're not advancing in time. And if it's negative, we're doing something that doesn't make any sense, our slice is going in the opposite direction. So if you wanted to prevent, because in principle you don't have any control here for h going to zero, or for the evolution of h driving the induced lapse to zero or negative. So then he added some terms here in this form with some appropriate factor here. And this is simply saying, okay, if the lapse is getting closer to zero, this will grow in a significant way, and it will add a very significant lower order term to this equation that will just clamp the value and not let it go to be too small values. Analogously, you don't want this lapse to be way away from one, because asymptotically, you have the feeling that you should be recovering flat spacetime if you're very far from the source, and so then he put a term like this, which, again, if the lapse is below one, you have one sign. If the lapse goes above one, you have the opposite sign, and it has a sense that will drive you back. And by suitably playing with these kind of conditions, then he found out some convenient terms that were the ones he used. What I want to say by this is just give you an example that, okay, A, you didn't lose the freedom that you had with your coordinates by choosing a special value for the Christoffel, the trace of the Christoffels. You still have the freedom. It gets translated into defining these H source functions in an appropriate way. And depending on your problem, then you might have to think carefully what is it that you have to do. There is no single bullet for everything you do. You might just have to begin. It's always safe to start with a zero. That's the simplest possible way. And by just interacting with the dynamics of the problem, seeing how the problem is reacted in numerics, you might begin to get some interesting ideas of how to choose H this way or in that way. Yes?
So these different kinds of prescriptions, wouldn't they, in principle, be kind of hard to test if they work or not? Like if you have a simulation that would take like a month to run?
No, right. So what you like to do is just run for a short time and begin to see what properties you have. Let me just write one more thing and go back to your question. So let me just write, suppose you're saying, well, I'm going to, once I define, this is telling me how H is going to vary. The way H is going to appear here is through setting this condition. And what you're doing is, implicitly, defining the coordinates to vary in this way, right? That's what, because this is true. That the trace of the Christoffel symbols is equal to the box of your coordinates. So this is what you're doing by choosing any h, either this way, that way, or putting a zero, this is what you're doing. So if we're saying that this, if we're saying that this is equal to hv, defined in any way you can, either through some judiciously chose set of equations or by God given, this is what you're given. You're tying this to that, and this is how your coordinates are behaving. And it's also customary to put a minus sign here, but this is convenience. That's what I'm going to use. So what we could do is just to try to get a better feeling, because one thing that interpreting this problem from the terms of GAB that we don't get is this nice picture in terms of the Laplace shift. But as I said, I mean, given that we have the metric GAB, we can always write it in terms of the Laplace, the shift, and the intrinsic metric of some given hypersurface. So what you could do is say, well, given that you know how to write the metric now in terms of Laplace shift and GIG, and you know that these are your coordinates, t, x1, x2, x3, well, let's rewrite these in terms of Laplace shift and intrinsic metric. So if you just expand it out, what is that equation using the fact that x are your coordinates and the metric is hidden in this box, this is what you get. So in terms of the quantities we define, this is what you get when you say box of HT, box of HI, where I goes from 1 to 3. So what it's telling us, and this is just at the formal level, we know that regardless, in all these cases, we will end up with a very nice system of equations, a system that satisfies these good hyperbolicity properties. So now reinterpreting in terms of the Laplace shift, it's already telling us some indication of if we don't choose to go in this direction, but we choose to go in this direction, how we are supposed to choose the Laplace and the shift. And this is a little bit of what you're going after, Antti. So if I look at this equation, it's telling me the induced evolution equations for the Laplace and the shift. This is how the Laplace and shift are supposed to change as you go through next sequence of hypersurfaces. Well, there are a few things that we have to worry about. So one, notice that let's ignore the h's for the time being. Let's even imagine that they are zero. This is telling us the alpha will change tied to the trace of the extrinsic curvature, which is intuitively what we want. We want that if the slice is getting bent like that with respect to, say, a previous slice, that should be represented by the Laplace. And however we choose the Laplace, if it is tied to that, that will perhaps go in the right direction, because now you're getting the dynamics of your slices and you're adjusting the Laplace in a particular way. Of course, what you want the Laplace to do, it's a different question, and we're going to get back to that in just a second. Let me describe a few more things and then we'll go there. The shift varies with respect to, now if I look at the sources, well, depending on the gradient of the Laplace, so it wants to know where things are curved here, and also the gradient of the metric. So it also needs to know about that. But now it's up to you what you want to do. So let me just describe two very different ways of dealing with a black hole. Suppose you want to do a numerical study of, say, a star that is collapsing. So you take one of the TOV solutions that Scott described last week, you go to one of these too massive for stability, eventually they'll just collapse onto itself and form a black hole, right? So at some point, these null rays get trapped, this the event horizon, and the singularity, well, get formed, and it's in your future, because the signature changes there. It's a time-like singularity that you're just going to hit invariable. So now, suppose early on, you choose your slicing, and nothing strange is happening. So your star is very, I mean, it doesn't have a lot of mass, and it's, the density is very low. The amount of, the self-gravity of the star is curving the space-time is not too severe. So just using laps equal 1 and shift equal 0 just takes you right on. But then at some point, you begin to get close to the event horizon. Now the question is, what do you want to do? Do you want to study this region very carefully? Or do you want to study the region far out very carefully? Depending on the answer to your question, you might want to use two different slicing. And I'll show you why. So in one case, you could say, well, I want to study really carefully this region, in particular this region where essentially the black hole, the singularity is about form. So what I could do is to have a slicing that begins to kind of slow down here so that I have a lot of, because a lot is going on physically during in a small region. So you want to put a lot of points in time and space there. So you could want to delay the way you're going forward in the future because that's your main point. Alternatively, let me just erase this part. You say, well, I really don't care about that internal region. I want what's going outside because I have a black hole that is distorted or is colliding with another one. I want to get the gravitational waves that are coming out. So there you could say, well, I can do another thing. I can choose a slicing that goes into the horizon. Now I'm going to have to deal with another problem because all this will terminate at the singularity, right? So the code will just totally blow up. So there you leave with that problem, but you'll address this problem in a different way. You're going to say, well, I can always use a technique called excision, which in a way you already use in the first example when you did the scatter field on a fixed black hole background. You only iterated so far into the black hole. So here what you say is, I can always cut my simulation short once I cross the horizon and not go all the way through. Because even if I cut it there, I'm not affecting the physics outside. Because this is one-way membrane. The information can go in, but it cannot go out at the classical level. So you created yourself a problem by saying, I will go into the horizon. And you're going to have to deal with it. And the way you can deal with it is with the excision. In this R1, you don't have that problem because you actually always slow down before the singularity shows up. But then you create for yourself a different problem, which is, okay, if you want to study what happens at late times on this region as well, then this is not going to be good enough. And so there are different ways of addressing that. So it depends what is that the physics you're trying to get. You're going to choose one set of coordinates or another. And you're going to, especially in this phase where you're in discovery mode, you don't really know how the system is going to behave. It will require some simulations and then try to understand what the dynamics is looking like. And hopefully you're not going to have to waste a full month just doing tests, but it wouldn't be out of the question. In some sense, you could argue that the field went through tests for about 10 years till the breakthrough happened. And now people are going after the physics, but for a long time, people were just getting more and more intuition on how to do things and what might be best. In fact, in some sense, it's ironic that one of the techniques, the coordinate conditions that were deemed to be completely useless for the binary black hole collision, with a very small tweak, all of a sudden worked perfectly for the black holes. It's a combination of these, plus allowing the coordinates to move around by choosing a judicial shift. We're going to get to that in a second. But so unfortunately, I wish I could give you this the set of golden rules that if you go through them, you're going to know precisely what you have to do at the end of the day. We really don't have that. You just have to get a little bit of intuition as you go along. But this kind of, these equations that tie, you can see how the coordinate in between, the coordinate condition between the Laplace and shift tie with some particular quantities, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, for instance, and the gradient of the field. It's a, and you, you know that in this way, you do get a good, a well-behaved equation that at least is telling you what degrees of freedom around what you can change things around without messing up your nice properties of the system. Okay. So just a few more things about this formulation. So the one where you choose gamma equals zero was called the harmonic formulation of Einstein's equation. If you add the word generalize, it's the one where you just assume there is an arbitrary source, and how you provide the sources, what determines the evolution of the sources is totally free. It's up to you. But let me just then say, so as a guiding principle for the formulations, we always want the formulations to be strongly or symmetric hyperbolic, the best possible one. Otherwise, we don't want to use it. As guiding principle for the coordinates, we're kind of getting the feeling now that we have to tie the coordinates to the dynamics. We don't want it to do it at the highest possible derivatives, because that will make things a lot messier. But we know we can do it through first derivative or zero derivative of the metric. That will not spoil any of the properties. And always we try to get as cleanly as possible something that looks like a wave equation, because we know that then we don't have to work in analyzing the system. We immediately know the properties of the system are the nicest possible ones we can think of. But the last thing we would like also to kind of guarantee, if we can, is that we control constraints. Even in the nicest possible case, it could happen that we begin to peel off from the constraint surface in an uncontrolled fashion. And what I mean is the following. So let me just use again the analogy with electromagnetism. Once you say you're evolving these equations, these are Maxwell's equations written in first order form. You can prove analytically that if you are at a given hypersurface, you satisfy this. At a later, and if you evolve to the next hypersurface through these equations will also be satisfied here. This we discussed yesterday. But numerically, you're never satisfying this exactly, nor you're satisfying this exactly. So who is to say that if you now go and imagine that this is some little functions that are non-zero, they're off zero, that these equations plus, the error here that you make in your discretization, you don't know that this, A, that you're solving Maxwell's equations, and B, that as you progress, you're going to stay close to satisfying this. So initially, you write your equation, you write your initial data that satisfies the zero to the best possible level, up to truncation error, say. So you have some error. But now you're not going to start evolving Maxwell's equations. You're slightly off Maxwell's equations. So this is a different theory. Where that theory is a good approximation to the Maxwell's theory, it's not clear, right? If the constraints begin to peel off exponentially, that's the solution you're going to get at a later time, while a correct solution will be the correct solution to this other theory you're evolving, which is not Maxwell's equations. Given that you have to live with the errors, you want to make sure, if you can, that all these errors will never take you really far from this constraint surface where Maxwell's equations actually live. The solutions for Maxwell's equations actually live. And it's not a priori clear that what you're doing will have that property. So if you can, it's good to work on that. And yesterday, we discussed a little bit this, and I left you as an exercise to prove that if you start with this one, and you imagine that your constraint is, well, gamma b, and let me now, because it's the discussion stays the same, let me imagine that the constraint is this one. Right? right? So we're choosing, these are our corner conditions, gamma b equal minus hb, right? We're assuming that this h comes from some particular prescription. So this has to be equal to zero. So this is the analog of d, say, b equal to zero. That's one of the constraints, say. So what we're doing, notice what we're doing in practice, what we're doing in practice is to say, oh, when I see gamma, replace it with h, or with minus h. So the equation you would be solving goes like minus 1 half g alpha beta d alpha d beta g a b plus gamma a, well, minus equals 0, right? That's what you do. You replace the h, the gamma for the h. That's what you do analytically. Numerically, you might be getting some little error that creeps in. So what you're doing actually is to say, well, let me go back to the equation, put a gamma here, put a plus, and put a constraint here. What I want to put. Yes. Oh, equals 0. So notice that if I add that, at the analytical level, what I do is adding a 0. At the practical level, this guy will cancel this guy and leave the replacement by h, right? You see what we're doing? We're just simply stating what we want to do, change the gamma by an h, and in practice, it's the same as taking the initial equation and sticking this term there. And so the equation in terms now lumping things together is like this. And if you follow the steps we discussed yesterday, what you would have been able to prove is that this implies for C the equation equal to 0. So the message from this equation is that let's imagine that you start with a very small error in your constraints. That means the C's are essentially order epsilon. So this implies in a wiggly form that box B of CA is equal to 0. And so it just says the wave equation in the curved space I'm applying to C is equal to 0. And you can prove that if the initial data is CA equal to 0 and dt of CA equal to 0, then the solution will be, say, A equals 0 for all times, assuming the boundary conditions are well defined. Furthermore, you can prove that if you have a small epsilon, if CA is ordered epsilon, and so is dt of CA, what you can prove is this CA will grow at most linearly with time. So you're going to have a constraint that peels off from the constraint surface linearly with time. And that's fine. You can always find linear functions by just making, well, with better resolution, you're going to get this epsilon smaller and smaller, and you can always guarantee that the error after the time of interest will stay bounded in a nice fashion. What you want to avoid at all possible costs is an exponential takeoff. Of course, we have to be worried because here we ignore this quadratic term in that analysis, and this quadratic term can source things and in itself can take things exponentially. So we would like to react from that. We would like to say, well, if the higher order terms begin to grow, we want to make sure, see if we can keep it down, keep them down. And so one way we can do is just modify this equation, which in turn will modify the equation we solve. So the simple kind of strategy is to say, well, let me just knock this off, is to keep adding zeros. Remember yesterday we in that fiducial model that we started with, we added in that ODE equation that we started with, dz dt we added a term with zero, but had the right sign for us to have z decay exponentially with time. So we can do the same, follow the same kind of rationale here and say, well, suppose we add to this the following. This is a free parameter. Now I want to stick zeros, but zeros that in the end will do the job that I want. Let me just call this in. So we said, rather than evolving that system, RAB equals zero, I want to evolve, first I want to evolve this system because this allows us to get the nice symmetric problem, this hyperbolic structure that we're looking for. But in addition, we add this one. Notice a few things. Because this term does not have a gradient of C, we're not screwing up what we work for in order to fix this problem. So we're only adding lower order terms. The thing is, we're doing them in such a way that we'll end up getting something nice. So here you can proceed. Yes? It's just a parameter. This one is just a free parameter. So let me just call it gamma. So we can do exactly the same thing as before. You can take the divergence of this equation, use the contracted Bianchi identity. Whenever you have the gradient of the gradient, so here we have two terms, the gradient A of CB, but also you have the gradient A, gradient B of CA. So commute the covariant derivative so the Riemann shows up. Once the Riemann shows up, use the equation again and simplify everything you can. And what you get at the end of the day is that this one now implies this equation. So of course, for gamma equal to zero, we have to get exactly the same thing we had before. But now we have a few more terms. This term, the first term, and the last term are the ones we had before. Now we added these two. What is the role of this? Well, just as before, let's imagine that you started your simulation, you worked hard enough to get a constraint that was sufficiently close to zero. So any lower second order term we're going to drop, so we're going to drop this guy, which has c squared, and this guy, which has c squared. Before, we had box of c equal to 0. Now we have box of c minus this piece equal to 0. So we have box of ca minus 2 gamma grad b and b ca equal to 0. So that a priori doesn't tell us much. For a general space time, it's difficult to say what the influence of this term will be. But there is one thing we notice. Let's imagine that n, at least locally, is just 1, 0, 0, 0, right? We imagine that's for simplicity. So then we can pull it out of the derivative. Once we pull it out, there will be one term that has nb and db. Right, so I'm going to have the following. Well, the twos, I'm thinking the twos, is like have one half of the two terms, so I'm just using that fact. And then I have nb, na, grab b. CB equal to 0. And we can ask the question, what is this doing to the equations? And let me just show something that probably is more natural. Let's remember this equation. That's the equation of a damped oscillator with natural frequency omega 0 and damping parameter 2 beta. The key thing here is that the damping in this problem came from this term, which is breaking the symmetry. Here we have second derivative of x with respect to t twice. If you make t goes to minus t, right, this term doesn't change. If you make t goes to minus t, this term doesn't change. But this one does change. And in this one, if you went forward in time, you had the oscillator getting damped. The oscillations in the system would get damped with time. If you go in the opposite direction, they would increase with time. And the sign of this guy, or the direction in which you went, determine which is the direction you want to go for a decaying thing. This one is pretty much the same thing. Here I have a box. Again, if I don't go t goes to minus t, nothing changes. But here, these two terms actually do break the symmetry. It tells you there is a difference where you go in direction forward or the direction backwards. And by choosing this sign appropriately, this parameter appropriately, you can see that indeed, for small perturbations on flat spacetime, and you start with a small violation of the constraint, the resulted system that you get after evolving this equation brings you back to the constraint surface. So if you start with an error of order epsilon and you wait some time, it will bring you back to the constraint surface. That error gets smaller and smaller as you go in time. So here what we did is, again, analytically, we did nothing because we added a zero. But if you're satisfying the constraints, if you now think, what is the theory that I'm going to be evolving or going to be implementing by considering this equation, but not that I don't satisfy the constraint, but I'm slightly off the constraint, it will tell you that that's a different theory. It's not Einstein's equations, but it approximates asymptotically Einstein's equation. And that is a key ingredient in this formulation for it to work. Otherwise, it just fails quite miserably every time you have very strong curvature. So any questions? So again, what I'm trying to argue here is that if you have any system, and this is generically, we don't have to be talking about Einstein's equations, where you are evolving a hyperbolic system, you have worked very hard in getting the best possible system to deal with. If you have some constraints, don't forget about them. A, you will need to monitor them as an independent quality check of the solution. If you see these constraints growing and growing, obviously you're doing something wrong. Or you're not doing as much as you should in order to get the solution that you're looking for. But then see if those constraints can come and help you at different levels. Here we brought them in to help the formulation evolve towards the constraint surface if you are violating them. In the example I'm going to show you next, which is the other formulation that is mainly used in the field, the constraints have been brought not to ensure that the constraints are driven back to the constraint surface, but to ensure that you get a hyperbolic system purely starting from the ADM, not from the four-dimensional point of view. So I'll tell you the main ingredients. There are many papers on this, and if you're interested, I can give you some reference on this. But I'll tell you what the main difference is with the ADM and how you break things out to get the right formulation or the right properties. The main observation is what we did yesterday, and that reappeared here. Remember yesterday we saw that if you tie the laps to the dynamics of the system, all of a sudden you went from a system that was ill-posed to a system that was well-posed. Here, it raised its head again. When we work there, we see that we have a perfectly fine hyperbolic system. When we reinterpret it in terms of what the coordinate conditions are in terms of the laps and shift, we again see that the laps and the shifts are tied to the dynamics of the system. So this ADM system of equations can be fixed by being mindful of the properties or the very same issues that we worry with this R1. So let me just remind you a few of the things we had in that formulation. I'm going to introduce a simple shorthand notation when I'm going to define dt to be the partial with respect to t minus the derivative along the shift. Or actually, no, I'm going to just actually lump everything there. The lead derivative along the shift vector. So the equations, the ADM equations were the following. And I'm going to, just as before, I'm only going to write here the terms that have a second derivative. And we have the two constraints that we'll bring in a second. So this is the Ricci of the three metric. We have exactly the same problem that we saw in the four-dimensional point of view. If I write the Ricci of the three metric, I write the same thing, minus 1/2 gamma, Lm dl dm gamma ij plus now di gamma j. Right? So the RAB was the Ricci tensor of the four dimensions when we wrote it, of the four-dimensional metric. This is the Ricci tensor of the three-dimensional metric, but we can write exactly the same expression. And so we see exactly the same problem as we saw before. There's one part of it. This is now the elliptic operator. That is, in conjunction with this equation, we end up making the box equation. But then we have this offending term. And what do we do there? So one option is to use the space harmonic condition. Which says gamma j equals 0. And I'm soon going to start not denoting things with a 3, because everything we're talking about now is in a 3 plus 1. So when I write tensors, they belong just to the space hypersurface, or it's a three-dimensional manifold. So that immediately will take care of us, of this term, and we would almost be home free. But now we have this other derivative, which is a second-order derivative. And depending on what we're doing for the labs, we may or may not be in good shape. So this R formulation, which is called the BSSM formulation, and stands for first this last two, Shibata and Nakamura. They were looking at cosmological problems a few decades ago. They work hard, noticing kind of they had the intuition that those terms need to be addressed, and they proposed a particular formulation. And later, in 98, Baumgartner and Shibata resurfaced the same formulation with slightly different combination of variables. So it's now known as a BSSM formulation of Einstein's equations, which share a starting point, the ADM. And from there on, it does a few things to address these problems. So the first thing, and for simplicity, and this is tied to this, notice that the lapse is intimately tied with the trace of extrinsic curvature. That's the only thing it knows. We also noticed yesterday that when we, in the ADM, we tied the lapse to the trace of the metric, we got a well-posed system. So somehow, the single quantity that you can get out of the extrinsic curvature or the intrinsic curvature was important. So it singles that out. So you say, well, let me introduce a different metric, gamma twiddle ij, which is related to the metric of interest by the determinant. So we're actually, this guy here is related to the determinant of this metric, and in particular, the determinant of the metric gamma tilde is 1. So a new constraint comes in, which is the constraint on the determinant of this metric. We're going to be evolving that metric. And again, what we're singling out is one, the determinant of the metric by its own. We want that to be its own variable. And we're going to do the same thing with the trace of extrinsic curvature. Those two we want to put in a special way. So that's one. So two, we're going to use this phi. And k, which is the trace of extrinsic curvature, as special variables. So now, because I'm accounting for the trace of extrinsic curvature as one of my main variables, there is a redundancy if I use the full extrinsic curvature. So I'm going to define another set of variables, which is, in three dimensions, it's just a trace-free part of k. So remember, in ADM, we would have had gamma ij, kij, this in ADM. In the BSSN, we take gamma tilde ij and phi. These two have the same information as this one. This one will have k and aij. So far, the only thing we've done is just rewrite some of the variables in a different way. Turns out, for reasons we'll discuss in a second, that it's better to rather than talk about the extrinsic curvature A of the metric gamma, is to actually deal with the extrinsic curvature corresponding to, associated to the metric gamma tilde. So from here, we are going to use just the I tilde ij, which is related trivially to the aij by e to the minus 4 phi. So now what we're doing is we're going to consider the tilde here because, again, it's the same, it's redundant information. We trivially can obtain the equations for all of this. So the derivative equation for the gamma tilde is very similar to the one we had before. Now, the derivative of phi is just minus 1/6 of alpha k. So these are the analog of the ADM equations we have here. Now we need to know what this implies for this one and that one. And it's just some algebra to get what they are, but let me just write schematically what those are. So now, the time derivative of k, notice the time derivative of phi, it's given by k. The time derivative of k is given by the second derivative of alpha. So we're going to have to be worried about what. Remember, when we pair variables that have derivatives, we're going to have to worry about what we do with alpha. That's going to be important. And the last one. Well, now we have to be careful. We need to write down this equation again, which has the Ricci tensor, and it has this one. The Ricci tensor, this is the Ricci tensor associated to gamma, but we want to interpret things, everything with respect to the tilde variables, the new variables, so we need to, from Rij, actually we want this one, the R tilde ij. But the good thing is the relationship between the tilde metric and the untilde metric is through just a conformal factor. And if you go, so maybe already know this, if you go to the last chapter of Wald, for instance, this is my source, there is a set of equations there that relates quantities that you naturally calculate with respect to one variable, one metric that is conformally related. This is a conformal factor related to another metric. And there's a very simple formula there that says if you know the Ricci with respect to one metric, and you want to calculate the R one with respect to the other metric with a conformal factor given by omega, then it's just a collection of simple terms. that you have to account for it. So I'm not going to discuss that, but I'm just going to tell you what, as a result, you get the most important pieces. So for R trivial ij, what you get is the following. Do you know this notation, if I put a comma, that I'm deriving with respect to those? Okay. Okay, and here is where we essentially hit the same point that we hit, or we got to in the R formulation. So when you write dt of A twiddle ij, so notice ddt of gamma twiddle ij is A, ddt of A till the ij, if I come in here, because it's given by the rij, and notice what I have here. This is, again, the elliptic operator, the part that if I combine it with the time derivatives gives me the Laplacian operator. This is perfectly fine. This is the same problem that we had before. Now we have derivatives of Christoffel. So now what do we do there? Again, we have the option of choosing coordinates where this guy will be identically zero or will be given by some God-given function. And in particular, what the decision or that is made is essentially say, well, let's define this gamma twiddle to be some H's exactly equal. And then we need to give a particular prescription for how the ages will evolve. So they become their own independent variables. And because they're set equal to each other for all times, they're not seen as constraints, one simply says, OK, these are my new variables. These are true new variables. So these are independent variables. Which, of course, introduce this set of constraints that said, okay, if I calculate the Christoffel symbols of this metric, I take the trace, they have to be equal to these ones. And this is a constraint that comes in along the fly. But because one will say, okay, I need to now add an evolution equation for gamma twiddle, they are independent. They have their own evolution equation. So these are just derivatives of a different variable. With respect to gamma, we have the wave operator again. Here is, I have to say these last few things. Well, who determines the evolution equations for gamma? Because I'm considering them as independent variables. I need to prescribe an evolution equation. So what you do is you go back here. You compute from here how the time derivative of the gradient of the gamma will behave. From there, you get what the time derivative of the trace of the Christoffel symbols is. And you get a complicated expression. That expression has a bunch of terms that actually you don't like because it introduces high derivatives that you need to either analyze how complicated the coupling is with the rest of the system, or what you can do is to realize that the term that comes in can be addressed by using the constraint. So what I mean by this is the following. This will have, if you just write down explicitly what it is, we'll have in one term, we'll have something like this. Derivatives of the A twiddle. And so now you work hard here to have this guy coupled with that guy in a way that was just giving you the wave equation. But this one brings it back. So now we have to be careful because then we don't have the wave equation. There's coupling with another variable. The good thing is that now what you do is you can use the momentum constraint to get rid of this term. If you use the momentum constraint, it says the derivative of the A twiddle equal to something. What you do is you see that term and you remove it by what the momentum constraint would be telling you if it were satisfied. So you enforce directly the constraint. Rather than in the previous system, you say, well, the constraints are there, they're on the side, I don't want to touch them. I don't want to do anything. What I do is I modify my equations in such a way that the constraints will be well behaved. Here I'm going to enforce directly the constraints, and therefore they will be playing a direct role that rather than an implicit role on the side. The good news is that once you do that, this term is gone, and the expression, the only derivatives appearing in that expressions are derivatives of the extrinsic curvature, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and derivatives of the lapse and the shift. So now you can analyze. You have done your duty to get this one and that one correct. Now you have to be worried about how these two couple, and this is where the gauge conditions come in, and you choose them in a particular way. So it turns out that once you put those conditions, which actually, again, are tied with this one, notice that the shift, the time derivative of the shift, has the Christoffels. So they are coupling. So if I now think of dt of beta, something that has derivatives of this gamma tilde, now I complete the coupling between this one and this one that has the derivative of the beta. And again, you can form a nice wave equation. So you're always trying to pair variables or pair a set of variables that gives you a nice wave equation. You end up with a correct, well-defined initial value problem, or well-defined set of equations to attempt the initial value problem. So we're not going to go much deeper into it. What I just wanted is so you can, if you grab the papers, all the description is there. What I just wanted to tell you that is that, well, at first sight, this thing about trying to obtain things that has nice hyperbolic properties looked like rather magic. I mean, it seems like we're playing God. We're putting some equations in, some equations we're taking out, some things that we don't like, try to redefine in terms of other variables. At the end of the day, we're always going towards trying to get these nice wave equations, or a system where we see the coupling very, very nicely between a subset of variables, and we can always analyze what the characteristics of the system are. We look at two very different formulations, one that starts with a full four-dimensional point of view, the other one that starts from the 3+1. And in both, the very same issues showed up, and we address them in very much the same way. So I think maybe we should be stopping here. What we'll do tomorrow is that now we're going to discuss two more things. Here we discuss the two main formulations, or if you're dealing with a different formulation, what are the things you should be worried about when you read the equations to understand where you're starting with a good system. What we're going to discuss tomorrow is how you even begin to define the problem of the initial value. So we have never talked about how you define data to evolve into the future. Again, we're going to end up in similar problems than the ones we described here to try to define a well-defined initial value problem. And we're going to keep promising this. At next class, I'll talk about this. But next class, we'll talk about how you extract information out of your simulation, in particular gravitational waves. But I'll point to this as well. So let's stop here, and we'll continue tomorrow.